This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Space Between Us, Rings, The Comedian, I Am Not Your Negro, and a look back at John Hurt in V for Vendetta. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the Home Cinema Roundup, this week featuring a new release of the classic Pinocchio. But before we get into all of that, this is how you can get in touch with me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news, it seems like every week I'm doing this, you know, Carrie Fisher, and then you had Mary Tyler Moore. Now we had another big name pass away this past week, and that was John Hurt. He had just turned 77. I mean, like 3 days after his 77th birthday, he passed away. Now, he had had pancreatic cancer, been diagnosed with it in 2015, and they had announced that he had been in remission, and it came back. You know, he was in his late 70s. He was an older man, and then generally it's a lot harder to fight a disease, especially something as aggressive as pancreatic cancer, you know, and that late in life. And pancreatic cancer is, man, that thing, that's what I believe killed Patrick Swayze. I mean, it is an aggressive disease, and when it gets you, it's very quick. So yeah, it is sad to see him go. He was an icon. He really was an icon. Everyone remembers him. A lot of people were saying in a lot of news stories, Harry Potter. And yeah, he played Ollivander, and he showed up not just in the first movie, but in later ones, especially in the last couple ones he kind of had bigger parts in. But I mean, going back to the 70s, you're talking about movies like Alien, the original Alien. He was the original chestburster. He was in The Elephant Man, which is a fantastic movie, a gorgeous movie, one of David Lynch's best films, also one of his most realistic films. His movies can be so fraught with dream logic and weirdness that The Elephant Man is such a fantastic movie. But he also did a lot of stuff just over the years. He showed up all the time. He's kind of like Jeremy Irons. Jeremy Irons shows up everywhere. Now, I went back and I watched 1984, which, of course, based on George Orwell's book, and because he was a star in that. And then I watched V for Vendetta because he plays the dictator in that movie. I'll be revisiting John Hurt a little bit over the next couple weeks, but those two are the ones that stuck out to me because as much as I know Alien, everyone talks about Alien, everyone talks about, you know, the Harry Potter movies, I'm always going to be drawn to 1984 because I remember seeing that in the theater. But later this episode, I'm going to talk about V for Vendetta because that sort of was my springboard off to that. So yes, John Hurt will be missed. He was a fantastic actor. The next piece of news is that Peter Capaldi is going to be leaving Doctor Who. He announced that this is going to be his last season. And I was really intrigued when Peter Capaldi stepped into the Time Lord shoes, because I'm like, that's something different. You know, we haven't had an old Doctor Who since, like, the seventh Doctor was older, Sylvester McCoy. But I mean, he was only older because he got older. I mean, in the 80s, he wasn't really that old. And like the sixth Doctor and the fifth Doctor were relatively young. The fourth Doctor, my favorite, of course, was, you haven't had really an older Doctor come step in the role, you know, post 50 years old since the first three, and really just the first one and the third one, which was John Pertwee. I was interested to see what they do because everyone didn't go for the young and sexy Doctor. And I think part of it, I don't even blame Capaldi as much as I kind of blame Stephen Moffat. I think Stephen Moffat just got so heavy with it and so dark and so, let's kill everybody that are involved with these people. He wanted a finality to everything, and he's kind of had some of depressing outlooks in his stories. I was never 100% into Capaldi as the Doctor, so it would be neat to see a new one come in, even though I respect a lot of what Capaldi did. Now, who do I think should become the new Doctor Who? Well, I mean, the winds are blowing towards Ben Whishaw, who was, of course, Q. He's the new Q in James Bond, and we've seen him in various things. He's a very well-known actor, and he's younger, and he's attractive, but he still could be a little nerdy. My personal pick, though, is Richard Ayoade from The IT Crowd. He's best known for The IT Crowd. He does a lot of stuff. He's a director now. And occasionally will be in front of the camera, usually in chat shows and quiz shows in the UK or like a host. I'd love to see him step back in front of the camera and be the doctor. I would love that. I know that there's a lot of people who like that idea. I don't know if that's going to happen. So Richard, if you're listening, please call the BBC. Couple pieces of just development news that are interesting. Denis Villeneuve, who of course directed Sicario and this year directed Arrival, and he's coming out with the new Blade Runner movie. He has been tapped to direct Dune. Now, I love David Lynch's Dune. I'm in the minority on that. I love that movie. I think it's fantastic. Admittedly, it's not quite like the book, and there are a lot of departures from it, but I just love the aspect of Dune. But I'm curious to see what he does, because I think he's a fantastic director, and I think he certainly proved, especially with Arrival, and I'm betting he's going to prove it again with the Blade Runner movie. He's good with speculative fiction. I mean, he can do futuristic and very realistic. He's sort of almost like a Ridley Scott, which is great. Now, another piece of development news is Ben Affleck, in terms of directors, has stepped back from the new Batman movie. He's, of course, going to play the Batman, but he's not going to direct the Batman. I don't know if this is tied to Live by Night's bad box office, which recently came out that Warner Brothers is taking a significant hit from that movie. But probably not. I mean, I think that there's a lot to direct and act in a movie. Although I don't know who they're going to pick. I mean, that seems to be par for the course with the DC universe, as people are doing musical chairs in the director's seats. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to talk about is the Oscar-nominated My Life as a Zucchini. It's been out, I think, in limited release, or at least at festivals, and it had a qualifying run, but it doesn't actually open technically in America until February 24th, so here's a trailer.
Hey, new kid, what do you do to land in here?
This girl, what's she like?
She has eyes that go right through you.
What if we get caught?
You want to know or not?
Yeah.
After my parents died, I went to live with my aunt.
We're going home.
No! Help!
But she's just cruel.
Then I won't let you go.
Come on, everyone! No more fight! Girls versus boys!
I love animation. I've always loved animation. This is done in stop-motion style, but a very rustic stop-motion style. It's not even like Shaun the Sheep or Wallace and Gromit. It's very stylized and sort of a unique look. This looks like it could be very charming. It's been picked up by GK Kids, who does a lot of great films, especially ones that are sort of like European content or something that doesn't necessarily hit the wide mainstream. They released Ernest and Celestine, which was nominated for an Oscar several years ago. And they also released movies like, they're involved with some of the Studio Ghibli pieces, and they did Song of the Sea and The Secret of the Kells. Those, I believe, were also GK Kids movies. I'm looking forward to this one just because I love animation, and I love just something unique and different. And it's a great looking style and looks like a sweet story. The last one I want to hit is Ghost in the Shell. This is the Super Bowl spot that you're going to see, of course, at the big game on Sunday. But here is a teaser of it, at least the audio, and it opens on March 31st.
They did not save your life.
This is quickly becoming, at least visually, one of my most anticipated films. I'm not a big fan of Scarlett Johansson, but I think she's done some neat stuff with science fiction lately, especially something like Under the Skin. I am looking forward to seeing what this reveals. I'm not going to go watch the original Ghost in the Shell again. I saw it years and years ago. Not a whole lot I remember about it. I'm waiting until after I see this, and then I'll go back and watch the original anime. But boy, the visual style and the sound mix sounds just really amazing. A realistic view of cyberpunk without looking like a crappy 90s movie. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Comedian and I Am Not Your Negro. Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I am getting ready to roll into the movie reviews. Let's start doing what I do. And we're just going to jump right in because we have a bunch to talk about. The first one I want to do is The Comedian. Now, it's a smaller movie. It's getting a smaller, limited release. It is opening in significant markets. It's opening in my hometown, Columbus, Ohio, this weekend and around the state of Ohio. So it's definitely something that is out there and you can check out. And it stars Robert De Niro as an aging acerbic comedian trying to put his life back in order as he comes to terms with the end of his career and the end of his life.
Here he is, my famous brother, Jackie Burke.
How are the kids?
Kid.
We have one kid.
She's an adult now.
She's getting married.
Got a possible gig.
What do I have to do at Julie's birthday party?
Do you want a job or you want to be an ass?
Do I have to choose?
What a schmuck.
Mr. Jackie Burke is in the house!
Adorable when celebrities bring their hookers to the club. Jackie Burke's in the crowd.
After everything I've done for you, I was there for you when you were starting out as a young man.
I guess I made that description a little too morose. He's not like dying or anything. It's just that he's older and he's at the end of his career. This is it. He has a lot fewer days ahead of him than behind him. And this is him looking back at he was once famous. He was on this TV show. And like most comedians who get on a TV show that becomes very popular and they're known for like just one thing, it wears on him significantly when people are meeting him and saying, oh, do this line or do that. I mean, I'm sure that every comedian that had like a catchphrase on a TV show always struggled with that. I mean, of course, like, you know, like Andy Kaufman just hated being shackled with the Lotka character from Taxi. And that's what most people knew him for, that and the Mighty Mouse song. So this is him looking back at what got him here. Now, the story is your very basic story about a guy sort of reflecting on his life and career and realizing he's getting much older. And he's also trying to find a relationship, and he strikes up a relationship with his woman, played by Leslie Mann, who's in her 40s. And of course, she's much younger than him. And he's butting heads with her father, who's played by Harvey Keitel throughout the thing. So it's kind of this hodgepodge of just this guy's life dealing with different things, like his brother, played by Danny DeVito, has a daughter who's getting married and she's a lesbian. So he's going to this lesbian wedding. And of course, that's something that a comedian is going to be, it's going to be irresistible for a comedian to speak publicly without, you know, throwing a couple jokes out there. While the performances are really good, in fact, Edie Falco, I thought was quite good as his agent. The thing I like the most is if you happen to know any comedians, I mean, stand-up comedians, this is almost depressingly accurate in how they're portrayed. Because comedians, while they're funny on stage, a lot of them are really depressing people. If you ever watch the show Louis, on FX, that's Louis C.K.'s show. It's sort of this hyper-realistic version of his own life. It really captures the depression of your comedians. Because a stand-up comedian is somebody who mines their own grief and problems to be funny. And so the ones that are the most neurotic, the ones that are having the most problems, are the ones that make the best stand-up comedians, because it is somewhat self-deprecating, and it really captures the reality of this world. I've known several comedians in my life, and they're all like this. And it reminds me of that movie, Don't Think Twice. That movie about the people trying to make it on a version of Saturday Night Live, and bust out of their own improv troupe. There's a depression about this, and they really capture this in this movie. So it's an interesting movie. It's an interesting look at the realism of a comedian's life. So I'm going to have to say The Comedian kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into another film. This one's opening in limited release, and it's a documentary from Magnolia. I Am Not Your Negro. The words of writer James Baldwin start out as a look at civil rights leaders Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King Jr., but become an examination of the black experience in America.
If any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, he is judged a criminal and treated like one.
The story of the Negro in America is the story of America. It is not a pretty story.
I'm a black man in a white world.
Most of the white Americans I've ever encountered, sure, they have nothing whatever against Negroes. That's really not the question.
The structure of this movie, well, the first, like, 30 minutes are kind of haphazard because it's this adaptation of a book that was never finished because James Baldwin died. So it does kind of have this sort of haphazard collection of memories of these three civil rights leaders and how he dealt with them. But what the movie ends up doing, it gains this focus about halfway through and becomes a movie about the black experience. It's very hard to watch a movie like this if you're not black, because you don't have that experience. A black person is the only person who knows what it's like to be a black person in America. That's just the way it is. And as much as I can imagine what it would be like to be a black person in America, I'm not black. I once wrote for a predominantly black paper in Columbus several years ago. And I remember coming to my first production meeting, and I was the only white guy in the room. So I know what it's like to walk in and be the only person of a certain race in a room, but that was for a meeting. I don't know what it's like to wake up and deal with that every day and deal with the institutionalized racism and privilege that you're dealing with in the world. This movie actually does kind of bring that all into focus. It looks at privilege from an artistic perspective. And the civil rights leaders form this backdrop, and the civil rights actions all happen as a backdrop, but they pull all these movies and show sort of the impression of the black experience. It comes from the black man's point of view. And James Baldwin's words in some interviews, he explains how you'd see something as a black person. Easy to start watching movies and have a chip on your shoulder and be like, well, I'm not like that, I'm not a racist. If you just back up and let him present this in the general sense, it's eye-opening. Because like it or not, in many ways, movies are a reflection of American mainstream. And when it's not, it's a reflection of what America thinks should be mainstream, which can make it even worse when this institutionalized racism shows up in these movies. And all you have to do is just go back and watch the movies, like, from the 30s. Forget the movies from the 50s and 60s. Look at the movies from the 30s. And even if it's not an accurate portrayal, it's sort of what white America thinks black America should be. And that's where the racism comes out. It also looks at the privilege. And again, it's very hard to look at this as a white person. You say privilege to somebody who's white nowadays and their back goes up. They're like, oh, no. But you have to realize you're coming from the privileged perspective. And there's nothing wrong with being privileged. That's just the way the dice rolled on your life. But you have to recognize that there are certain things that you have an advantage of. Because when you walk into a room, you could be Jewish and no one's going to know. But you walk in a room, you're black, it's pretty obvious. And that is with you all the time. So this has a great way to put you in the black perspective, at least just enough to just sort of see. It's sort of like looking through glass at the black perspective. You still don't know what it's like, but you get a little bit of a peek in it. And that's what makes it a good movie. Now, what's interesting, I had to edit this trailer, and it was a bear to edit because it has the N-word in it. And even the name of the movie is not the actual quote from James Baldwin. I just find it sort of sad that overt racism is still okay in many circles, but some words aren't, and you can't put those on the radio. So I'm going to have to say, I Am Not Your Negro rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Rings and the Space Between Us. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Let's talk about Rings. 15 years after the first outbreak, the videotape that kills with a phone call returns to a world where videotapes and home phone lines are obsolete.
I keep thinking about this story. There's this video that kills you 7 days after you watch it. The second it's over, the phone rings, and this voice says,
"That's when she's coming for me."
I sort of had a little bit of fun with that introduction, but that's the big problem that I have with this movie. Before you talk about anything else, videotapes are really a thing of the past. Videotapes now are what the 8-track cassettes were in the 80s. They've had their due. They served their purpose. And while there's the hipsters who like to watch VHS tapes now and then, because they're hipsters, generally, I mean, as much as collectible as it is, I don't ever see VHS coming back to the collectability market to the level that, say, vinyl has, because there is a certain thing you can argue about a superiority of vinyl sound. There's nothing superior about videotapes. What makes the videotapes interesting is their degradation and their imperfectness. I'd much rather have a Blu-ray. I lived through VHS. So these people who think that, VHS is so cool because it's nostalgic. No, I'd much rather, I have movies on VHS that I would never watch again because I have them on DVD, at least, but then Blu-ray is way better. That's just all there is to it. But there's a kitsch to it. But even now, it just, this whole series, this franchise, seems to be a pre-2005 franchise in the sense that it'll work. Well, yeah, I guess they answer cell phones in this movie. But how many people don't answer? I never answer a cell phone. It comes in as an unknown number. I let it go to voicemail. What if you get the voicemail and there's a voicemail from Samara going, 7 days? Anyways, this is, of course, trying to reboot The Ring as a franchise. And the first movie came out 15 years ago. It was directed by Gore Verbinski, starred Naomi Watts, and it was fantastic. It was an amazing movie. And in fact, if you go back and watch the original Japanese Ring U, which came out in the late 90s, personally, I think that Ring U is kind of a boring, nonsensical movie. I think that Verbinski really got a focus on The Ring. Nah, the sequel to The Ring wasn't very good, but boy, that first The Ring was fantastic. And part of what made it so good was there was a beauty in its simplicity. For as convoluted as that videotape is, it really has a very simple story to it. And that's what I found so appealing about it, because they were unveiling that very simple story. Well, you know the story. You know Samara. You know she's in a well. You know, this is stuff that's nothing new. And so they get these characters and the tape makes a, or the video makes a resurface in an old VCR that a guy picks up. And then it's a story of these college students doing tests under the direction of Johnny Galecki from The Big Bang Theory. So basically Leonard Hofstadter is doing evil tests at the university, where he's trying to use this to prove that there is life after death. And the whole thing is that you have to pass it along to somebody. He just designs this string of people, and of course things go wrong. And then they start looking into Samara's past. Now, it's been a long time since I've actually seen The Ring, but I really felt like they were kind of going over the same road as the first one did. I'm like, doesn't this happen? The last time they tried it, this happened. So it seems to be almost a remake. It's like it's a remake, but a sequel at the same time. Like I said, what made the first one work so well is its simplicity. This one is at times needlessly convoluted and kind of goes off on these weird tangents and in a weird direction where they're no longer searching for the what's behind the tape, but what's behind the tape. It's just, and there's a load of coincidences that happen along the way. It's another crappy teen/college horror movie for the modern age, when they're just too disposable and weak. I mean, we're not talking about like teen horror movies from the 70s and 80s. where that was the essence of grisly, visceral horror. In this movie, it's like another PG-13 horror movie that comes out in January or early February, and we've seen these before, and they're forgettable and really not worth much. So this is just disappointing. Anyways, I'm just going to have to say Rings sucked.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Space Between Us. A 16-year-old boy who was born and lived his whole life on Mars is determined to get to Earth and fall in love with a girl from Colorado.
My best friend isn't even real.
Tell me about it.
That hurts my feelings.
Tell me where you're really from.
Mars. I was born here.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I'm from a different planet, too.
I want to go to Earth.
He's met less than 15 people. He's being denied connection. His physical development is at the perfect place to do it.
His heart can't handle our gravity. It's too risky.
The best thing I can say about it, at least it's not vampires. It's a teen romance, but at least they're not like vampires or werewolves, which has been done to death. No pun intended. The story, of course, is this kid who grew up on Mars, and he gets there because his mother was pregnant when she was on a mission to Mars, and doesn't realize until she's in mid-flight. She's in space when she realizes she's pregnant. The beginning seems extremely rushed, and that's because they gotta explain why they're going to Mars, they gotta get going to Mars, they gotta realize she's pregnant, you gotta give birth, you gotta land on Mars, you gotta do all this stuff, and then you gotta build this habitat, you gotta be here, and then the kids gotta wanna come home, and then the whole crux of the movie is this love story between him and this girl. Now, somehow they're like text messaging or chatting, Skype chatting, from Mars to Colorado. How they're getting past the whole speed of light barrier, I have no idea. They don't even acknowledge that. They don't even say, oh, we have a special quantum tunneling technology that allows us to talk instantaneous. No, they just ignore the fact that it takes several minutes at least, I don't know what the light minute distance is between Mars. And then it depends on where the two planets are in relation to themselves and the sun. But the movie itself ignores so much science at the same time trying to be very scientific. And that's where it struggles. You get a movie that's nonsense like Transformers, you can be like, well, we don't need to explain why robots can talk because it's a Transformers movie. But here they're trying to make it like a realistic Mars film. It's predictable. It's corny. It's cheesy. But with that said, this is not made for me. This is made for teens and tweens. This is made for people who want to see sort of that interplanetary love story, something that goes beyond just the girl next door. And, you know, like I said, about 45 minutes into it, it does turn into these young kids on the run kind of movie, which is a very different film than what it starts out as. There's certain parts that are appealing. And I imagine if I were 13 watching this movie, I probably would have loved it. But as an old fart in my mid-40s, who's very cynical and been through various things in life, I look at it and I just kind of roll my eyes. I mean, like I said, at least it's not vampires and werewolves. But the scientific mumbo-jumbo is so hard to get past because it's hinging upon being a scientific movie. It's horribly predictable. There's things that were happening in the movie that I'm like, well, this is the catch. And it takes another hour, and then they're like, surprise, this is what happens. And I'm like, well, I saw that coming, surprise. The actors are fine in it, but it's just mediocre. It's a stretch to get to this level. So I was surprised it's not actually based on a book. I felt, oh, this totally feels like a book. But in terms of teen movies that have come out, I mean, it's way better than like The Fifth Wave, which came out last year at this time that nobody remembers. But yeah, it's okay. I guess if you're 13 years old and want to go on a Valentine's Day date, it's an okay movie. But still, I'm going to have to say The Space Between Us kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about V for Vendetta, the weekly box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Pinocchio. There
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. I am going to continue with the movie reviews. I'm not going to review a new movie. I'm going to do a look back at certain movies. Either I'm going to give a movie another chance that have either become topical or they feature an actor that has been recently in the spotlight. And in particular, what started this one for this week is John Hurt, Passing of John Hurt. Like I said in the first segment, I remember him, of course, from Alien and Harry Potter, but I always remember him from the movie 1984. And I do want to talk about 1984, but I'll talk about that next week. And then I wanted to watch V for Vendetta, because one of the things that was the neatest part that I found, especially back in 2005 when V for Vendetta came out, was that John Hurt went from playing Winston Smith in 1984, the put upon member of the Outer Party, and then in this movie he's the dictator, and to the point where they have the imagery of his face on the big TV screen, very much alluding to Big Brother, not just in the book 1984, but the movie itself. So I thought that with the passing of John Hurt, this was the perfect time to look at V for Vendetta again. Part of the thing is, as I never liked this movie, and I know it's gotten a lot of notice and it's remembered fondly. And I remember I just did not like the movie at all when I first saw it back in, I guess it would have been early 2006 because it was delayed. It was originally supposed to come out 2005. It got delayed because of a terrorist attack in London, and it got moved to 2006. So I wanted to revisit this and take a look at it more than 10 years later. So V for Vendetta, in a future dystopian totalitarian England, an anarchist in a Guy Fawkes mask causes chaos in the government by waging a subversive war.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
Gentlemen, I want this terrorist found, and I want him to understand what terror really means.
Her parents were detained when she was 12.
It was like those black bags erased them from the face of the earth.
You have one chance. You must tell us the whereabouts of Codename V.
There's a lot of stuff that has happened over the last 10 or 12 years that have brought this movie back into focus. And one of them is the Guy Fawkes mask. The fact that that has now become a symbol of, it started out as kind of a symbol of anarchy, and it still is. I mean, anarchist groups will wear it, but it's also considered a look of rebellion and revolution. Anonymous is best known for wearing the Guy Fawkes mask. The ironic thing about that is Warner Brothers, Time Warner, one of the biggest corporations on the planet, gets a royalty for every one of those masks that is bought, because that image, that smiley cartoonish image of Guy Fawkes is trademarked and owned by Warner Brothers. So if you go buy a mask because you want to stick it to the man and say, screw you, corporations, part of your money is going to Time Warner, one of the biggest corporations on the planet. But with that said, I have to say I still did not love V for Vendetta. And part of the problem is it does get very talky. And I remember I went back and looked at my review from 10 years ago. That's one of the things that annoyed me about it, is there was so much talking and so much what appeared to be needless dialogue. And having read some Alan Moore work in graphic novel form, it makes sense, because Alan Moore is a very talky guy. And if you watch like Watchmen, he's very talky in those characters as well. So I can see where this didn't translate quite to screen, where these big, long, extended speeches by the character of V. I will say this, I like the movie a lot more now. Part of it is, at the time, it was almost trying to be overtly political, as it is. It's more a good sense of the general in terms of talking about totalitarianism and what can go after, as opposed to sort of sticking pins in a map and criticizing directly what's happening in the global marketplace. And that's one of the things I like about it, is because you remove it from the issues of that day, 12 years ago, and it's more poignant at times to stuff happening now and around the world, because it's not so directly talking about something. 1984 is very much the same way. It's very relevant, but removed from the yoke of the Soviet Union, it's actually even more relevant, because it's what could happen as opposed to what is happening. And I think V for Vendetta's still got some problems. It still has a focus issue. It still has a meandering plot that kind of goes crazy at times. It does step on its own toes, and it does lean towards a watch the world burn. It's like the Joker made this movie and is like, let's just blow everything up. And you're like, well, let's get some middle ground here. But it's still an intriguing film. And I got to say, now, and looking back in retrospective, outside of the political realm of 2005, 2006, I think it's a more interesting movie. So I'm going to say V for Vendetta kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk real quickly about the box office. Last week, I said that Split was probably going to win again with around $20 million or so, and it did well. It did win. It made $26 million, which is more than I had originally said, and that's a really good hold. It was only down like 35%. A Dog's Purpose did okay with $18 million. It could have made more if it wasn't a controversy, but it's still a hit. And Resident Evil did exactly what I said it was going to do. I almost matched Underworld's number of $13.5 million, and Gold just barely made it into the top 10 with $3.5 million. Now, this week, honestly, I don't know what's going to win. People are pegging Rings for saying it's going to be about $20 million. It might, but it's very possible. If Split holds well, it could come in with $15, $16 million and still beat Rings if Rings falls on its face and crashes and burns, which is very possible, considering it's a low weekend due to scant choices in the Super Bowl. So we'll see. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight of the week goes to Pinocchio. Almost 80 years after it was first released in theaters, Walt Disney's sophomore animated film about a puppet come to life that wants to be a real boy comes out of the vault for another release on Blu-ray, and for the first time on digital HD.
I can move. I can talk.
Cricket's the name. Jiminy Cricket.
He's my conscience. Father!
Pinocchio!
I'm a real boy!
You are a real boy!
If you haven't seen Pinocchio, I suggest you rewatch it, because it is a terrifying movie. I mean, yeah, it's a cute kids film. It's a Disney movie. It certainly plays to a child audience. And I think part of the reason is, to a child, it seems very plausible, you know, talking cats and foxes and anthropomorphic animals and kind of going into this forbidden zone, which is what Pleasure Island was, and the danger of turning into a donkey and a giant whale coming after you. These are things that kids accept, because kids are basically smaller, insane versions of adults. When you become an adult, the fantastic becomes more fantastic. It becomes very hard to wrap your brain around. And you watch this thing as an adult, and in a way, it is terrifying. It is a movie about a child that could get killed around the corner anytime, and slavery and capturing kids. And what do they do with the donkeys on Pleasure Island? People have joked, wouldn't it be interesting if, like, Guillermo del Toro did a version of Pinocchio? That thing would be a nightmare. But it's still, as a movie, it's a whimsical, fun Disney movie, because it also has that early 40s feel to it for something you wouldn't be able to make now. And it's a classic. It's an icon. Of course, it introduced us to Jiminy Cricket and some wonderful songs, like When You Wish Upon a Star. So yeah, I love Pinocchio. It's so bizarre and out there and surreal. And that's what makes it so special. Now, this is not the first time it's been on Blu-ray. It came out for its 70th anniversary about 7 years ago. They now have it on Blu-ray again, but this is the first time it's on digital HD. And while it has all the features from the previous release and the DVD features, there are a couple newer ones on the list. Not a ton of stuff because, I mean, it's, you know, God, it's over 70 years old. So there's less to mine in this one. But you still get some audio from Walt Disney's planning meetings. So you get the look back into the vault of the archives of Walt Disney of what he was trying to do in putting this thing together. The most interesting thing is you do get his look at what Pleasure Island was in the original version. I mean, bad enough that it's called Pleasure Island, but it was really going to be called Booby Land. But you know, as much of a horror show as Pinocchio does turn into, if you look at it in the, through the right lens, it could have been even worse. It could have been terrifying. And then on top of it, you just got a great, wonderful little classic Disney movie that a lot of people haven't seen in a while. So it's a good time to revisit it out of the vault. Pinocchio totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it. I need to go for the week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the Lego Batman movie, 50 Shades Darker, and John Wick Chapter 2. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.